Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my apologies. I don't seem to get a few PowerPoint slides. I do have handouts of the slides, and I'll try and just go through a few of those. Well, thank you for this opportunity. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about soybean rust. This is a pretty serious disease threatening soybeans, and one of the best descriptions I've heard of this disease come from Dr. Marty Graber, who calls this an aggressive, hungry beast. And I think that's a very appropriate description of this disease, because it's a disease that can quickly defoliate a soybean field within 2 weeks, and it's also one that can cause yield losses of up to 80%. Soybeans is obviously a huge crop in the U.S. It's up to $18 billion crop. There's 73 million acres planted annually, and here in Minnesota we have about 7 million acres. The economic impact to the U.S. to agriculture is estimated between $240 million and $2 billion. Soybean rust affects not only soybeans, it also affects a wide range of other legumes, and there's estimates anywhere from 30 to 60 species of legumes are affected by this disease. Such crops in Minnesota include clovers, sweet clovers, peas, dry beans. I should point out that humans and livestock are not affected by this disease. Soybean rust was first discovered in Asia in the early 1900s and has quickly moved across the globe. It reached Africa and India in the late 1990s. It jumped over into South America in 2001. And then was contained south of the equator for a couple of years. The equator forms kind of a natural barrier against soybean rust. In 2003, it moved into northern Brazil and then moved into Colombia last year.
Mr. Rizzo, if I can interrupt you just for a second. Members, we have a quorum. I'd like to officially call the meeting to order. Representative Finstead, would you move the minutes? Representative Finstead moves the minutes from the February 23rd meeting. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The minutes are adopted, and we will continue.
I'll continue.
No problem.
With technological.
Yeah, we have technical difficulties here often. Not a problem, Mr. Friesel. Please continue.
Okay. One of the interesting features of soybean rust is the fact that it is it's an obligate parasite, and because of that, it has to have a living host material. So there's been some work done as to how far south it overwinters. And on the bottom of page 2, you can see some projections as to how the likelihood of its overwintering in the United States. And basically, southern Texas and southern Florida are the two areas where it's most likely to overwinter. There was some conjecture early on that soybean rust wouldn't survive this winter because of the freeze went so far south this year. But just this morning, I learned soybean rust has been already found in Florida, so it is still existing in the southern U.S. The last two slides on page 2 is just an overlay of soybean acres and kudzu acres, kudzu being a very significant host, and that's an overlay with the overwintering areas. On the top of page 3, I just showed a slide. In the upper right-hand corner is a slide from the southern U.S., which shows the prevalence of kudzu, which is a host for soybean rust, in the close proximity to soybeans, and that's why it's so important, and why the South can now be considered the new rust belt, because it's this is an area that's going to remain. The next few slides are not nearly as interesting on a picture, but this is some work that was done by Dr. X.B. Yang from Iowa State University, and it basically tracks Hurricane Ivan and overlays that with the movement of spores northward. And as you can see, starting on September 5th and through the 18th, there is the wind pattern is such that it sweeps up through the southeast part of the United States, and that's where the predictions were for soybean rust deposition. In the upper right-hand corner, and again, it's difficult to see, but there are some points in that map that show where soybean rust has been found in those states. And there's been 9 states where soybean rust has been detected. Those middle slides are simply slides indicating an overlay of soybeans, crops, and kudzu with those soybean rust deposits.
Mr. Friesel?
Yes.
I think for the committee members' benefits, could you define for us what exactly a kudzu is?
Chairman Blaine, yes. Kudzu is it's a legume or in the same family as soybeans. It's a very prominent weed in the southeastern part of the United States. It was actually introduced initially as a way of soil stabilization or conservation, and has really taken over as a very major weed. It grows over power lines and houses, and it's quite a prominent weed in the southeast part of the state.
Other than kudzu, is there other legumes out there that act as carriers for the soybean rust other than the soybean plant itself?
Yes, Representative Lane, there, that's one of the dangers of soybean rust, is it has such a wide host range of other legumes. So there's a number of not only legume crops, but also wild weeds or plants like sweet clover that have become somewhat weedy in nature, which serve as an inoculant source.
Okay, very good. Please continue.
Okay. On page 4, the bottom left-hand corner, I think is a very interesting map. It's actually a risk map that looks at the suitability of epidemics in the United States. There's a hatched area that shows the soybean growing areas, and unfortunately in black and white, this doesn't show, but the southeastern part of the United States has a very high probability of risk for soybean rust developing. In Minnesota, the risk is about 15 or about 5 days out of or 5 years out of 10 that we will have conditions that are conducive to the development of soybean rust. Even though we have a 50% chance of having a year that's conducive to soybean rust, that only means that the conditions are there. You still need to have the spores there, and you still needs to be in a time frame when soybeans are susceptible. One of the things we did about a year and a half ago, Commissioner Hugesson took a trip to Brazil and was saw firsthand how the significant impact of soybean rust on agriculture in South America, and he directed us to develop a Minnesota soybean rust action and response plan. And that's one of the things we have been working on now for nearly a year and a half. Some of the elements, or some of the members that developed this plan include the Minnesota Soybean Development Council, the Soybean Growers, the University of Minnesota, the Department of Agriculture, and USDA APHIS. Part of that plan is intended to clarify agency roles and responsibilities. It lays out a communication outreach structure. In fact, Mike Schromer from our communications office is planning a weekly news update as soybean rust develops this coming summer. We've also developed protocols for sample collection and submittal procedures, and we've developed an active soybean rust steering committee that's meeting at least monthly at the University of Minnesota. One of the interesting factors that developed before soybean rust was even found in the continental U.S. was there was the establishment of a soybean rust assessment team. And the intent of this team was to go to the first report of soybean rust in the United States and to do an assessment and survey. Minnesota served as the test site for this exercise, and we used what's called an incident command structure, which is used very commonly with fire protection and police organizations, and that structure is trying to be adapted to agricultural emergencies. Rosemont Experiment Station University was very generous in providing their facility to run a practice exercise for this soybean rust assessment. Interestingly enough, soybean rust is considered a bioterrorism agent, and because of that, we had to include law enforcement as part of this mock exercise, and that's what this slide was intended to point out. We did some things using, on the bottom right corner, page 5, we had kind of moon suit things, and that was intended to prevent the further distribution of soybean rust, but was decided that being an airborne disease, that really wasn't very practical when it came down to it. Moving on to page 6, after the mock exercise in September, frankly, most of us were feeling pretty good about ourselves that we'd have another year to get ready for soybean rust. Here it was, most of the fields were being harvested, and we felt there was very little likelihood of soybean rust showing up in the United States, and we'd have one more year. On November 9th, while I was in a meeting in Georgia on sudden oak death, I got a frantic call saying that soybean rust had been found in the United States. And this was discovered by plant pathologist Ray Schneider from LSU. And he was showing a farmer from Illinois some plots in Louisiana, and he was shocked to see what he thought was soybean rust. And sure enough, he sent it in for confirmation, and it was confirmed on November 9th. And then that following day, the assessment team was sent to Louisiana. I was very fortunate, and I had an opportunity to tag along and visit a number of fields in Louisiana and Mississippi. And sure enough, a number of areas were found were positive for soybean rust. In the middle of the page is a picture of a Dr. Arnie Chance. Two things I learned in Louisiana is you don't walk very far in kudzu, and that's what kudzu looks like. And the other thing was you want to watch where you're standing because there's fire ants just about everywhere you go. And I had the first hand opportunity to discover fire ants. One of the things the department was very aware of was the need to have sufficient fungicides available for farmers to combat this serious disease. 2 years ago, there were only two compounds that were registered to control soybean rust, and their efficacy was somewhat questionable. John Cirk from our agency, working with Dr. Marty Draper at SDSU, developed a national template or a reference Section 18. This is an emergency registration. And what we did was to seek multiple compounds, and generally, EPA will only allow a single state to request a single compound. So this is extremely unique. Not only did we seek multiple compounds, but it was also a national template that other states could utilize. The other very unique thing, which has never happened before, is that this was a registration that was sought before the organism was even found in the United States. I should mention that Paul Lemont from our department, who is the current president of American Association of Pesticide Control Officials, worked very closely with EPA in order to get this very unique and unusual Section 18. A couple of other things I wanted to mention about Section 18. We now have seven compounds labeled for soybeans, but soybean rust also attacks dry beans. It also attacks peas, which in Minnesota is a major producer of peas. So we've recognized that there was also a need to obtain additional fungicide registrations for peas. So there's a national effort underway, currently being led by Florida and Tennessee, to develop additional compounds for those crops. The estimated cost to farmers should soybean rust show up in Minnesota, they're in the middle of the page 7. There's some estimates. But on average, I would say it's going to cost farmers about $15 an acre to control soybean rust. And the unfortunate thing about soybean rust is the most effective treatments need to be put on in advance of the disease occurring or at very low stages. So farmers are going to have a some difficult decisions to make as to their level of comfort or risk with soybean rust. I should mention in closing that there is a national soybean rust incursion plan that's being developed by USDA APHIS. Minnesota's been very involved in the development of that plan. It involves developing some decision or management criteria for fungicides, which will be further developed by the universities, and it provides a framework for monitoring soybean rust, and then also a web system where information collected from states can be uploaded and into some predictive models. In Minnesota, it'll be very important for us to be aware of what the soybean rust situation is in states or areas to the south of us in advance of this disease moving northward, so that farmers have ample opportunity to make decisions. And then finally, I would mention that organic growers, there is no real treatment options. If you're an organic grower, there's no approved organic treatments. I will say that I've heard from a number of organic growers who are moving from more southerly soybean growing areas into Minnesota because it's less likely it's going to get this far north. There are some trade implications with soybean rust coming to the United States. Mexico is still considered free of soybean rust. I'm not sure how the hurricanes skipped Mexico, but because of that, Mexico has implemented some trade restrictions on U.S. Soybeans, and as has Colombia and some other countries. The issue of bioterrorism, as a vera bioterrorism agent, it's still classified that way, which creates some regulatory difficulties for us. Those are being addressed, and I should mention that Commissioner Hugesson and Deputy Commissioner Periostas have met with some of the high-level folks at USDA to try and speed up the declassification of soybean rust as a bioterrorism agent. And then finally, I just wanted to emphasize that the preparation for soybean rust in the U.S. has been very much a cooperative and a team effort between state and federal agencies with the Soybean Growers Association. And I especially wanted to recognize Dr. Jim Curley with the University of Minnesota and Mike Youngerberg with the Minnesota Soybean Growers Association. So, and my apologies for the my inability to get my slides working.
Thank you, Mr. Friesel, for your presentation. I have a couple of comments or questions here, and then we'll open up for questions from the rest of the committee here, too. Number one, Mr. Friesel, can you tell us if you know of any efforts underway now as far as developing whether it's chemical companies or seed companies in cooperation with the chemical companies as far as developing a GMO soybean seed that would be resistant to rust?
Representative Blaine, that's a good question. It's actually something that's been underway for quite a number of years. There is several thousand selections that are underway looking at soybeans resistance. The estimates that I have heard is that we're still 5 to 10 years out before having a viable resistant variety for farmers to use commercially.
Mr. Friesel, if I look back on the one map here, if I can find it again on your handout here. I can't find it now. It was a map here of the state of Minnesota here. Oh, on the map, the suitability for epidemics on page 4 in the bottom left-hand corner, right over the state of Minnesota, and right in probably the center part of the state, actually probably right over my farm, there's a very low frequency for occurrence there in that part of the state of Minnesota. And I'm just curious why in that part of the state of Minnesota or in South Dakota or to the west that are we seeing less suitability for an epidemic here.
Representative Blaine, I don't think they recognized your house when they put these maps together.
I wish they would have.
The map is based, there are two environmental factors that come into play, and one is temperature. You need about 60 to 80 degrees, so fairly warm temperatures for epidemics, and you also need 6 to 12 hours of free moisture in order for infection to occur. So these maps are built on some of the past climatological data, and what they're looking at is temperature and availability of free moisture. Why there's that piece there in the center, I'm not sure.
Well, as long as we don't have it too close to home, that'll help a little bit. But so much the better, is right. My last point, I want to go back to the kudzu issue. And I realize in your previous comments you had mentioned there is a number of different species out there that act as carriers or inhabitants for Asian rust out there, but kudzu seems to be a very popular plant species in especially in the south. Has there been any look or effort into controlling that if it's considered to be more of a weed than a valued plant or crop out there?
Representative Blaine, I think that's a good point. I actually asked a similar question when I was in Louisiana, and one of the folks from the Louisiana Department of Agriculture told me that actually the kudzu is grazed to a certain extent by cattle in that area, and it is used in areas where there's a lot of steep slopes continue to be used for some erosion control. So there is an element of the population in the south that views kudzu somewhat favorably, but overall it is extremely widespread. To control it, I think, would be an immense undertaking, and I think it would, until some sort of a biological control system or something like that comes in, it would be, in my mind, next to impossible to control it with other strategies.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Friso. Members of the committee, questions? Representative Hamilton?
Just a quick question, Mr. Chair. Mr. Friso, you may have addressed this. I was out for the first part of your presentation. But, you know, we understand what the threat will be here in the United States. What are some of the threats currently as far as exports, soybean exports? You mentioned something towards the end of your presentation as far as Colombia possibly putting on additional restrictions, but I thought Colombia had soybean rust. I thought I read that somewhere. So if you can just comment once again on exports and what that means to the U.S. growers.
Mr. Friso.
Chairman Blaine, Representative Hamilton, first to Colombia, the soybean rust has been confirmed in Colombia by U.S. Department of Agriculture. The Colombian Department of Agriculture continues to deny that this particular strain of soybean rust exists. And I suspect that that is being done for trade purposes. And the same situation exists in Mexico. Mexico is indicating that they have not found soybean rust in their country. Because of that, they are saying that if you ship soybeans to Mexico and you have more than, I think it's 2 or 3%, I forget the term, but it's basically stems or twigs from harvest, then you would be required to fumigate those beans before you could ship them into Mexico. And so those are the main in trade issues where pests are involved, it's generally the country that does not have that pest is implementing various barriers against the country that does have the pest. And since U.S. now transitioned in November from not having the pest to having the pest, other countries are putting up barriers. And some of those are accurate based on real risk, and sometimes it's more of a political situation.
Anything follow up? Do we know what the economic impact that'll be for those barriers? Have we had any studies as far as the economical impact?
Chairman Lane, Representative Hamilton, I haven't seen any economic analysis at this time. I don't think that Minnesota ships a huge amount of soybeans to Mexico. So I think the impact of our state, at least as far as Mexico is concerned, my guess is it's very small. I also think that it's going to be very soon that Mexico will have to will be put in a situation where they'll have to recognize that soybean rust exists in their country as well.
Ms. Friesel, kind of along those lines of Representative Hamilton's questioning, is it correct to assume then that that soybean rust can be carried literally by the beans of affected plants then?
Representative Blaine, it's never been found actually on the beans, and that's why imports of soybeans has really not been too much of an issue. It's when you have contamination from stems or from the harvest, because it's an obligate parasite. It needs that living tissue material, and apparently the seed itself is not susceptible to infection by soybean rust, so that would not be a carrier.
Okay, thank you. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Friesel, what would be the impact of a BL3 plant pathology facility at the University of Minnesota in dealing with soybean rust? What could they do?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl, having that facility available right now would, especially at this juncture where it is still considered a bioterrorism agent, there are a lot of restrictions that are in place for the movement and the containment of diseases like soybean rust. So there is an advantage to Minnesota to be able to conduct, when you have that level of security or containment, that gives you the ability to conduct research locally or have local experts looking at the disease. My expectation is that it will be deselected very soon. So from the standpoint of soybean rust, it's changes a little bit.
Representative Rudolph, don't follow up?
Not exactly following up, but thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just help me to understand a little bit. You said that in Minnesota, 5 out of 10 years, we had good conditions for soybean rust. So if I have a little example, let's say we have a good year and we actually have soybean rust, and then a real cold winter, what would be the effect then the next year?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl, the effect is it will not overwinter in Minnesota, and it's been the prediction is that it will freeze back to about the 28 degree temperature line. So wherever you get down to as far south where that 28 degree line, that's about as far north as soybean rust will overwinter. So you're really starting the cycle fresh each year. So Minnesota starts with a clean slate each spring.
You're welcome. Any other questions, members? Seeing none, Mr. Friesel, thank you for your presentation. Members, we have folks here from the University of Minnesota, from the Environmental Sciences, Michael Schmidt. Um, Mr. Schmidt, welcome to the committee. If you'd state your name and position for the tape and proceed with your presentation.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Michael Schmidt. I'm an associate dean in the College of Agricultural, Food, and Environmental Sciences at the University of Minnesota. Joining me today and representing the university is Lisa Bankin, who's a regional crops extension educator in Rochester, and will speak following my comments. Thanks for allowing us to make some brief comments on this very important issue for Minnesota. On November 9th, as Geer just mentioned, when Asian soybean rust was confirmed in Louisiana, one of the people that was invited down to Louisiana immediately was Jim Curley, plant pathologist in our department and within the college. Within 24 hours, he was in Louisiana providing expertise to develop and implement a response and action plan to deal with this threat. I wish Jim were here today. However, he's at a national soybean rust conference in southwest United States. Jim is our lead soybean disease researcher, but he's supported by a strong cast of many other experts in various crop and biological science disciplines at the University of Minnesota. These research experts work on the St. Paul campus as well as throughout Minnesota at our research and outreach centers. Many research projects on soybean rust are currently being developed and planned as we speak. This research is important to us in understanding how soybean rust spreads, how it affects crop growth, and how management and chemical protectants can aid in controlling its spread and its impact on the crop. Such research is a key ingredient of the Minnesota Early Warning System that will use climate data and spore deposition to predict the spread of this disease from the south. In addition, researchers and extension specialists are planning to use a statewide network of sentinel research plots to learn more about this disease and, most importantly, its control. As Minnesota's only research university, we take seriously our obligation to be the source of new ideas and new knowledge about soybean rust. We also take seriously our obligation to make sure that our research just doesn't stay in the laboratory or in an office. That's why campus and regional and local extension faculty are key members of our soybean rust team at the university. Lisa Bankin will tell you more about that education program in a minute. University researchers and our extension personnel provide seamless integration in working to provide the research and education Minnesotans need. Research is quickly translated into practical management recommendations. Soybean rust and the threat it poses our state's $1.3 billion crop is too big just for one organization. Since 2002, we've been working closely with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, as Geer just mentioned, as well as the Minnesota soybean growers, who we'll hear from shortly, to prepare for dealing with soybean rust. We have formed a soybean rust task force to gain efficiency in our handling of this threat. Virtually all of our research and education efforts are in collaboration with these partners. We are proud to be part of a solid partnership that benefits all Minnesotans. Now, I'd like to turn it over to Lisa Bankin, Regional Extension Educator. While Lisa's work primarily deals with educating producers and ag professionals in crop management, she works closely with our departmental research faculty and conducts field research on pest management issues. Lisa.
Ms. Bankin, welcome to the committee this afternoon. If you would state your name and position for the tape, please, and proceed.
Okay. I'm Lisa Bankin, and I'm with the University of Minnesota Extension Service, and I'm located as a regional extension educator in Rochester, Minnesota. Okay. Soybean rust, as you've been hearing, is obviously a very serious disease, and it can devastate soybean fields if it's not managed. Extension, research, industry, consultants, farmers, and government agencies must continue to work together as a team to learn how best to manage this disease in the United States and under the United States weather and crop growing conditions. My coworkers and I have actually spent the last year trying to educate producers and ag professionals about soybean rust and what the possible impact might be on our soybean fields if and when it arrived in the United States. We did this via a number of different educational methods, through meetings, field days, ag professional field schools, websites, and a lot of media effort. Well, as you've heard, rust has arrived. As of November, it is confirmed in the United States, and as of yesterday, it is confirmed to have survived in Florida. So it is here. Because of this, our educational efforts will have to intensify, and we've actually made some changes in our winter programs. Now we're focusing on soybean rust management across the United States, where it would survive, how to manage it when and if it reaches Minnesota, how to scout your fields, how to identify it in the field, and how to use fungicides properly in the field so you get the best benefit. I had the opportunity to spend the last 2 weeks in Brazil studying soybean rust and how to manage this disease. The trip was made possible by the Minnesota Soybean Research and Promotion Council, along with the University of Minnesota Extension Service. I was one of 28 people, university researchers, extension educators, farmers, crop consultants, ag professionals, and ag industry personnel from across the United States to participate in this two-week trip. The messages were very clear throughout our trip in Brazil. First, soybean rust is a very serious disease, nothing like we've ever dealt with before. Number two, we must intensify our research, education, and scouting efforts to prevent huge losses. Number three, we must use fungicides wisely, only when needed, and at the right time. This will be very critical to get the best benefit and not to overuse this resource. And four, we must work together as a team across disciplines. That's one thing this group of 28 certainly came away from, is Minnesota is not an island. We need to work together across the United States and learn from each other. So the team across disciplines, universities, ag industries, producer groups, governmental agencies, we have to work together to understand and figure out how to manage the disease. Early detection will be very critical, via proper scouting and disease identification. It will be critical so that we can minimize the soybean losses and the use of fungicides. The University of Minnesota will play an important role in providing research-based information to our farmers, our consultants, industry professionals, and others as far as how to scout and identify this disease, how to make fungicide applications, and then, of course, most importantly, evaluate the results of those fungicide applications to make sure we're doing it properly. Again, working as a team, the multiplier efforts is the only way we'll get this message across. At this time, as you've heard, fungicides are the only option to control rust. There is a lot of work going on to develop resistant varieties, but we have not been successful around the world to find that. So currently, fungicides will be the only method to control rust. They must, though, be used judiciously. Research is needed throughout the United States and in Minnesota to answer these key questions. Educational efforts will need to be intensified to share those research results, and the support from the Minnesota Soybean Research and Promotion Council has been a key effort as far as helping us to actually make a difference, and it has helped with our efforts already. Some of the key management questions that we do need to answer for our Minnesota growers include, first of all, do you have rust in the field? Can we identify it? Do you need to apply fungicides? What time of the season has rust shown up? Is it going to be worth our investment? When should you apply it? Sooner, later? What type of fungicide? Which one should be used so you get the right control? How should you apply it? Pressures, rates, very different than how we've applied herbicides and insecticides in the past. What products should you use? Do you need a second application? In some seasons, we might need a second application. And then, of course, what type of management do we need to employ so that we don't develop resistance and have other problems that will magnify this issue? Winter survival was confirmed yesterday in the United States, as I mentioned, in Florida. So rust is here, it's in the United States, and it's a matter of what the weather conditions do, the winds, and what happens in our growing season as to whether Minnesota will suffer from soybean rust this year. We as industry, professionals, farmers, extension, researchers, the Soybean Research and Promotion Council, and government agencies, again, must work together to manage this new disease and threat to soybeans. Just as we've done with other issues like soybean aphids, we must work together, use our strengths, and then as a team come to solve this problem. The other point is that each growing season here in Minnesota will be different. It will not be the same. As Deer said, The fact is that soybean rust needs to move into our area each season, so the growing seasons will be different. It's imperative, then, that we keep communications open, we work across state lines, we share our results, information, and concerns, and then, of course, help solve those problems. Our strength as the University of Minnesota is through our research and through the education in teaching people how to apply what we have learned through our research efforts. That is key, and that is where I work. We will continue to use technology, of course, to get rapid dissemination of any of the information we learn. And here, of course, is one example in using websites in order to make that information available to the public. This site, of course, is a cooperative effort through the University of Minnesota, the Soybean Research and Promotion Council, Ag Agency, and Industries. So it's a great cooperative effort, but this is the way that we will manage this the most efficiently and effectively to reduce and minimize the risk to our farmers. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schmidt and Ms. Vanken. Will there be, Ms. Vanken, will there be a training programs for, let's say, those involved in the agronomy field, those who are private agronomists or through other companies out there to help detect Asian rust as it does come here, and at some point in time, I'm sure it will get here, but can you answer that, please?
Yes, Chairman Blaine. There is a training session set up right now for March 28th in what we call a first detector, which would be the first group of people that would go through some intensive training on how to scout for and how to identify the disease. I just learned, too, that there is a second one actually being established in April. So we have two sessions set up, and this will be open to extension educators as well as crop consultants and industry personnel, other ag professionals. So it will be an open program led by several folks from the University of Minnesota that will take charge in that. But in addition, it will be critical, and I think that's where some of my role comes in with my counterparts, is that we will need to be out in the field this summer scouting very intensively and doing workshops as we can, but then multiplying the efforts as I work with ag industry so they work with their folks and we continue to spread, because this isn't just you can't just do it on your own. We need to be out scouting fields, and we need to encourage farmers to get out and scout their fields and to be looking for something different and very early on in the season. That's why I relate back to soybean aphids. It finally got us out in the field looking. This will just get us out there that much more.
Very good. Very good. I applaud your proactive approach to this problem, too. Yeah. What's you thought your Representative Magnus said he thought he was done locking soybean fields, but questions from the committee members. Representative Pennis.
Yeah. How long, thank you, Mr. Chair, and how long do you have after you notice it to get it sprayed before you've lost it?
Representative Pennis, that's a great question. What I learned in Brazil is probably about 10 days under their growing conditions and the climate that they have. It moves very quickly. And so that's where scouting early and intensively is going to be critical. What we don't know, because we haven't dealt with it in the United States or in Minnesota, of course, we don't know what that window will be, because our weather conditions are going to be different and our soybeans actually grow differently. We have different, as far as the structure of our plants, are indeterminate beans, and they grow differently than what the beans in Brazil do. And so there are factors as to what the soybean canopy looks like, what our weather conditions are like, how wet we've been, how warm we've been. Those kinds of factors may actually open up the window just a little bit more for us than what Brazil, which I would call the worst case scenario, would be. But in the worst case, about 10 days to minimize or probably get the best return from our fungicide. But I should also say that doesn't mean that all is lost. What it would mean is that you've lost something, but you can still protect the rest of the yield. You just didn't get the best return at that point in time.
Any other questions? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To either of our two testifiers, I saw an article not long ago where an organic farmer was saying he had found a fungicide that he thought was certified for use with organic soybeans, and went on to comment that the application that he was using, he decided to use in a very limited fashion, because where he really wanted to focus was on soil structure and soil microbes. Is this part of the conversation that you are having as you look at possible remedies? I know our previous speaker said that it didn't appear that there is any remedy that would assist organic soybean farmers at this time. What do you think?
Representative Johnson, interesting points, but what we've learned really is, again, that fungicides right at this point in time still are, that is the only way to really manage this disease. However, there's a lot of research that's going on. Again, since I was in Brazil, I heard of some other research looking at some other products that are always being tested. But I think in long term, what we really have to think of for organic growers as well as other soybean producers across the country is resistant varieties will be the key. That is what will be the other alternative. And we have developed that with wheat when we had wheat rust and other diseases. So it is possible through plant breeding. It's just right now this disease has been one that's been very successful in breaking down any of the resistance that they've found so far. The genes have not been stable. But they certainly are not, they continue to look and search. But I really think from what we know today about the disease, since we, again, haven't had any research here in the U.S., what we know today, though, is that developing resistant varieties will be the key for our organic producers as well as our other producers simply to minimize the use of fungicides.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Members, we also have comments here, presentation by Larry Muff from the Minnesota Soybean Growers Association.
I'm actually Robin Hanks. I'm from the Minnesota Soybean Research and Promotion Council. I serve as treasurer, and I'm from Leroy, Minnesota, and I'm also the chair of the Research and Tech Transfer Committee.
Okay, welcome to our committee, and please proceed.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak. The Minnesota Soybean Council has worked toward a coordinated effort of early detection and communication with the Minnesota Department of Ag, the University of Minnesota, and the USDA. Through the North Central Soybean Research and Promotion Research Project, which is actually made up of 12 Midwestern states, plus USB, that'd be the United Soybean Board, Minnesota is helping fund the Sentinel plots in each state, and USD will be funding a rainfall collection filtering system for early detection. You can see through our communication effort through both North Central and United Soybean Board these three items that she's passed out: an identification pamphlet and then a rather large pamphlet that was put in Midwest publications, or actually national publications, for in Corn and Soybean Digest. And I guess thanks for the opportunity to speak. I want to turn it over to Larry Muff.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hanks. Mr. Muff, you'll state your name and position for the tape and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Larry Muff. I'm Secretary of Minnesota Soybean Growers, co-chair of the Research Tech Transfer. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today about rust. Minnesota Soybean Growers is working with American Soybean Growers Association to provide a coordinated communication effort in conjunction with Minnesota Department of Ag, University of Minnesota, and Minnesota Soybean Growers. One of our responsibilities is to provide the farmer's voice in the Minnesota Rust Task Force efforts to prepare the monitoring, training, identification, management plans. One of our responsibilities is to educate legislators on the national and state level about the impact of rust and how they can assist in proactively preparing for rust. Minnesota Soybean Growers is working in support of the University of Minnesota and Minnesota Department of Ag to get a level 3 facility at the university for researching rust. Without it, we cannot effectively study rust in Minnesota. Now, Mr. Frigio mentioned that we have a potential of rust being declassified as a bioterrorism agent here shortly. But even if it is declassified as bioterrorism agent, it is critical that we have a level 3 facility here in Minnesota. As we know, rust may not be here every year in Minnesota. It will be very hard to do research to find a soybean variety that is resistant to rust in Minnesota if we do not have an environment here to simulate rust impact. With a level 3, on the years that we do not have rust in Minnesota, we can stimulate rust in the level 3 facility. It would be hard to do a coordinated research effort if we only have rust every once or every other year. We need to be on a research project that on this level. We need to be studying it continually, nonstop, where we need a level 3, even though rust may not be in Minnesota. So the level 3 is going to be critical for Minnesota soybean growers and the whole upper Midwest. Several weeks ago, I had the opportunity to be in Washington, D.C. on the MARL program. I met with Dr. Matt Royer, Senior Program Advisor in the Plant Protection Quarantine Division of APHIS. Dr. Royer gave a presentation on rust. And in this presentation, Dr. Royer praised Minnesota. He was participating in the mock drill Minnesota held last year on the mock exercise on rust. He said Minnesota was the only state in the United States to hold a mock exercise. And he said the information they got from this exercise was invaluable to them and critical. There was a lot of things that they discovered in this mock exercise that they had no indication that they would need to address. So he said it was very beneficial on a national level to hold this mock exercise, and I commend the University of Minnesota for putting it together. And Dr. Matt Royer also praised the quality of personnel that we have at the University of Minnesota, Jim Curley, and also Gary Frigio, Department of Ag. He says he relies heavily on their expertise and their knowledge and is in constant communication with them on the rust issue. So it's nice to hear on a national level credit coming back to Minnesota for the quality people we have working in Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today, and if you have any questions, we'd be willing to answer them.
Questions from the members? Representative Bennis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the amount of soybean checkoff?
0.5%.
So 0.25%.
0.5%.
Half a percent.
Minnesota
share.
Minnesota's share would be half of that. The other half goes to the United Soybean Board.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Muff, after your meeting in Washington here recently with the discussions that took place there, I'm just curious, is there interest by some of the other soybean growing states here outside of Minnesota that are looking at possibly instituting their own mock drills now after the success that we've seen here in Minnesota?
At this time, I'm not aware of any mock exercises. I think we've probably moved beyond the stage of mock exercise because bee and rust has already been identified in Florida next summer. The trade winds will be taking that northerly now along the eastern coastline. So I think a lot of the effort is going to be actually getting out into the rust fields down there and identifying it. But I'm not sure if other states are going to be doing a mock exercise or not, so I'm unaware of it right now.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you, Mr. Muck. Mr. Hanks.
Thank you.
Members, we're going to shift gears here right now, and we're going to begin the overview of the beginning dairy producer payment study. And I'm going to ask David Winand from Minnesota Department of Ag to come forward. For members of the committee, this study was put forth by legislation of this past session, and so this will be our first look at the review of that study. Mr. Winand, welcome to the committee this afternoon, and if you'll, as usual, state your name and position for the tape, and please begin.
David Winand, Minnesota Department of Agriculture and Grants Administrator. The beginning dairy producer payment study, as you mentioned, was commissioned by previous legislation last year, and the goal of this initiative is to ease entry of producers into dairy production and in the long-term increase of milk production in the state of Minnesota. The report is being distributed as we speak, and I'm going to skip forward basically to the third page of the study. The Department of Agriculture got input from a number of different individuals, producers, industry, the Minnesota Dairy Initiative teams, Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, Farm Business Management Instructors, Extension, and many others. The overall input was that this could be a positive as it relates to helping producers get started right out of the gate. On page 4, Farm Business Management Instructor Jim Kelm from Red Wing assisted me in doing some what-if type scenarios. We use an actual farm, a beginning dairy producer, looking at what would happen or how would this affect this beginning producer. The assumptions, and this is a real farm, the assumptions we used were that a beginning producer was renting a barn and 140 acres for $16,500 per year. The annual production was a little over 19,000 pounds, and the price that producer was receiving was $13.75 per hundredweight of milk. This producer had purchased the cows and heifers as if he or she had purchased an entire herd and picked it up from point A and moved it to point B. Each scenario looks at the extra dollar per hundredweight that would be generated based on the production of 20, 40, 60, and 80 cows. Principal and interest payments were increased progressively with each increase of number of cows. And bottom line, there is a positive cash flow even without the inclusion. There's a positive cash flow excluding principal and interest payments, but an operation would not show significant cash flow to cover operating expenses, family living, debt repayments until they reach that 65 to 70 cow mark. The department has put together a couple different options, looking at page 6, looking at the legislative language. Basically, that's the legislative language that is currently in Representative Otremba's, or that she's planning on introducing. Another option that could help producers get started included a loan program, reissuing some money from the Rural Finance Authority, reshifting some of those dollars around in order to make them additionally available for producers. And finally, a third option would be a rent credit on a producer renting a barn. And with that, I will answer any questions that the committee may have at this time.
Questions from members? I have a couple. Mr. Winan, if I go back to the graph or the spread on,
yep,
on page 4, and we're looking at a scenario here, 20, 40, 60, 80 cows, we're not seeing a positive net worth change to that producer. Even with 80 cows, is that correct?
No.
80 cows does have a positive net worth change, but if a program was instituted as it relates to this, in order to meet off, in order to meet family living expenses and other expenses as relating to a beginning dairy producer, off-farm income would need to supplement that difference in order to make a significant difference as it relates to net worth change. Net worth change basically will look at the replacement of assets that basically have become worn out and need replacing, in order, or additional borrowing or money out of savings would have to be incurred in order to have a positive net worth at the end of the year.
So I understand this right. The you're talking $16,500 a year for facilities. Is that correct,
Mr. Chair? What I'm talking about is $16,500 for rental of 140 acres, buildings, as well as a full line of equipment.
And the production numbers that you had built in this scenario was 19,000 pound herd average.
Correct. Which is 1,000 pounds over the current state average.
Which is exactly, which is 1,000 pounds over the state average, and an average milk price that year of $13.75.
Correct.
Mr. Wyden, can you tell me what the average milk price in the state of Minnesota has been the last 5 years?
The average milk price over the last 5 years is
$13.74.
But always with averages, you have your highs and you have your lows.
Yep. Okay. So as we look at this analysis, though, a dollar per hundredweight is really not returning a difference here until we get to the 80 cow level, and even at that level we're only seeing a marginal return then.
Correct. This is assuming that the farm is the sole source of income for that farm family.
Okay. Other questions here at this time? Representative Otremba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many farms did you use in the development of this chart?
We use a farm, an actual farm with their actual expenses and production figures.
Mr. Chair, did you do any scenarios with somebody who owned their farm and didn't rent any acres?
Mr. Chair, Representative Trump, no, we did not, because under the assumption that a beginning dairy producer would want to minimize their overhead or their debt load, renting a facility was the, or a rent-to-own type situation was an easier way to make that transition into a long-term asset.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, on the rent to own, was that were the payments for rent, etc., applied then to the cost of the farm?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tremba, yes,
okay.
But we only went out approximately 5 years as it relates to analysis of this program.
So, Mr. Chair,
Representative Trimble,
do you think that's the average that they rent before they buy? That's not my experience, but I rarely see anybody waiting 5 years. Usually it's about 3 years, and then they decide if they're going to buy or not.
Mr. Chair, Representative Trumbo, we were looking, we were just trying to assess the impact of this program as it relates to the purchase of the farm or renting a farm. It was only an effort to try and reduce the overhead expense.
Okay, and Mr. Chair,
Representative Trumbo,
using the fact that that in the program they have to be a part of the farm business management program, and we know that increasing into everybody that takes that program increases about 3,000 pounds. Did you factor that in also?
Mr. Chair, Representative Trumbo, no, we did not. We only, in an effort to be true to a snapshot situation, we only increased the production on this beginning producer 1,000 pounds over the current state average.
Mr. Chair, even though that you know through the farm management program that it is 3,000 pounds that it's increased, and that's average, so there's some lower and there's some higher, so I guess if I would have been doing it and I wasn't doing it, I certainly would pick more than one farm, and I would pick several scenarios, and because we know that there still are like 37,000 people in this state milking, and they're doing 50 cow herds. So, and I don't know if it's right or wrong, but I think the percentage of, you can maybe tell me, what's the percentage of farmers that there is a off-farm job? I don't remember what the percentage is. It's pretty high.
Mr. Weiner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Chamba, I honestly don't know.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Trumbo.
Do you think this is a fair analysis when you only look at one farm?
Well,
I mean, if I was doing a research project and I looked at one farm for a class, I'd have gotten an F.
If you want my opinion, there's numbers here, Representative Otremba, that I think are very generous.
Mr. Chair, think and doing a research project are two different things.
I don't know how many more I would, if the first one I looked at and I'm seeing these kind of returns, I don't know how much time I would look at expanding this. I mean, we're using some very generous numbers here to come up with very little return in the end run. I mean, I've been in the dairy business my entire life. A 19,000 pound herd average, to be expected to have a, I'm just looking at this scenario, and to be honest with you and members, if you're going to take a beginning dairy producer and you're going to have them purchase 60 cows or 80 cows or heifers out there and expect them in the first year to milk 19,000 pounds, to average 19,000 pounds, I don't believe is realistic. Even some of the top herd managers in the state would probably argue that is not a realistic figure. 140-acre building site right now. A site with buildings, 140 acres with buildings, for $16,500 a year, would be great. If I could find facilities, opportunities like that, I think I could fill them. In fact, I have a young gentleman right now, you know. Yeah, and as Representative Penna says, if you throw equipment in on top of that, my herdsman who comes from your county, Representative Otremba, I believe was probably playing closer to $25,000 or $28,000 a year for a similar situation like that. And I know the availability of finding a facility or a situation like that, I think in the state at this time would be maybe difficult. But in the end game, when we look at this, after 5 years in a net positive net worth of 530 on 80 cows with the grant, and then we're going to take that dollar a hundred weight away from them, I feel we're kind of pulling the rug out from underneath a beginning producer there. But that's an opinion of mine. Representative Chamba.
Actually, they can do this for 5 years in the bill, and they're capped at $10,000 a year. But this is a five-year program.
Yep.
And I think you know, you have some points, but I do think when you do a study, you have to do a cross section across the state, different sizes of farms, different scenarios, having purchased or not purchased, taking over a family farm. There are a lot of dairy farms that are out there that people are trying to rent out, but the young farmers cannot get the cash to do that. There are several in my area who are looking to have their buildings and their crops rented out. But the fact of the matter is, without the grant, they're even doing worse. And in order for us to put some of these family farmers back on the land, where they want to be, they want to be milking cows, it gives them that extra boost, which they don't have, and they would be even in more debt than they are now. I think we have to look at, if we truly believe in the dairy industry and we truly believe about putting farmers back on the land, we've got to take some risks. And I believe $10,000 extra dollars a year, and so do a lot of young farmers that I've talked to. $10,000 a year is a lot of money. I don't know how you started out. You started out probably like the rest, but we certainly scrimped and saved and did all kinds of things to cut down our housing costs as far as food and clothing and all that. And there are lots of farmers out there doing that, and that extra $10,000 a year is a lot of money to a farmer right now, because they're not making it at all. They're going backwards totally, and at least this would give an opportunity to break even.
Representative Otremba, I applaud your desire to help the young producers who want to enter the dairy industry in the state. But on a fiscal responsibility issue, if you gave me $10,000 a year, each year for 5 years, to invest for you, and after 5 years I gave you $530 as the return on that, would you say I've done a good job of, or would you say that would be a worthy return on the $50,000 invested?
Well, Mr. Chair, actually, the small dairy farmer spends most of their money in the community. And so that $10,000 per year is usually multiplied by 7. Because they spend all that money locally. So yeah, it's a lot of money. That multiply 7 times $10,000, that's $70,000 a year that's gone back into that community for economic development. You bet it's a good investment for me. as a someone in the government looking at taxes. They're spending their money, they're paying more taxes, and it's an asset to the community. A community, a family has stayed there. It's kept our schools open. It's kept our hospitals open. It's kept our church in the community. You bet.
Representative Pennis, you had a question?
I think you answered it, Mr. Chairman, because I question how you could get 140 acres, a barn, and evidently equipment, maybe I'm wrong, for $16,500 a year. I was kind of thinking that the principal and interest that was listed here was for the cattle that you'd have to purchase. Okay. And I just thought it probably was a little lean. I mean, I don't live in the greatest farmland in the country, but man, to get a barn and all set up, well, not all set up, but I mean, reasonably, seems light. So that was my question. Maybe I'm wrong.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Winan, I have a couple of questions. First of all, how do you have any estimate how many young farmers would participate in this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl, currently there's approximately 60 to 70 dairy farmers that get started in the state. Assuming that this would kickstart additional producers, approximately 100, maybe 110 would be affected by this program.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Follow-up, Representative Erdahl.
Thank you. Mr. Wyman, you've done the research on this. Well, let's just say that you're a young dairy farmer or want to be married. Your wife's making $20,000-$25,000 a year. Would you take advantage of this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl, as a individual exploring the possibility of dairying, if I could find a deal like this individual found for $16,500 for acreage, equipment, and have a family living of $30,000, I would seriously consider it.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to follow up what Representative Otrimbo was asking as far as the numbers that we were presented here today and how realistic this is. I think Representative Pennis brought that question or concern up, and you yourself brought up the concern about the amount of pounds produced off of this dairy herd, especially for a young and beginning farmer. Can we take a look at what our net worth, net cash flow, and then subsequently the net worth after 5 years, using some numbers that may seem to be more realistic than what's presented in this financial analysis?
I'm not sure if you're addressing that question to me or to Mr. Winan. I guess I didn't follow what you're saying. Would you like to? Are you saying you'd like to plug differing numbers in?
Well, what I'm saying is, Mr. Chair, the question that Representative Otrimbo brought up, she has concerns with this chart, and I think I heard that also on this financial analysis that was presented to us. I think a number of people sitting around here had questions or concerns on this also. And if we're looking at moving forward with a program to get individuals in the dairy business, I personally want to make sure that we're looking at accurate numbers, something that is sustainable subsequently. And I guess that's what I'm asking, whether that's a question for you, Mr. Chair, or for our guest here. But
Mr. Winan, when you put this study together, do you have this in a type of a computer program where we would be able to change the variables and do the runs on that again to see how that would come out? Would that be possible,
Mr. Chair? Representative Hamilton, yes, that is a possibility. The
FinPAC program does allow for changes, modifications to the numbers to adjust higher, lower as it relates to. And what I can and will do is have an additional runs done on this farm, as well as get input as it relates to additional farms, so that there isn't any bias towards a producer that's renting or a producer that's purchasing a livestock facility or something like that. The only reason I attempted to look at these numbers is because it is a real live farm, and it is a beginning dairy producer, early 20s, young couple with a young child, and I could increase, I could decrease the family living, but I didn't feel comfortable decreasing the family living any less than $30,000 pre-tax.
Okay. One other question here as I look through this here too. When I look at the first paragraph on page 4 here, at the end it says, paying $1,800 to purchase each cow and $700 to purchase each heifer. Those animals would be the animals that would be in the milking string. Is that correct, Mr. Winan?
Mr. Chair, that is 100% correct. And with the current price of livestock out there, $1,800 for a cow is perhaps maybe $100 higher than what you could buy a cow at an auction barn at today. But heifers for $700 is a pretty sweet deal.
That's a tremendously sweet deal, but especially because since we're looking at $700 heifers that are going to be in the milking string here, and this is, I think, is another area where I'm very, makes me very concerned with this scenario and the workability of this scenario. I've been in this business long enough, and if you're going to milk 60 cows, you're going to have, you should have, I'm going to say, probably at least 1-to-1 backup of replacement heifers. So we're going to run what you're proposing to do with this scenario, and Representative Otremba, take note of this. If you're going to have a producer out there, beginning producer out there milking 80 cows with no replacements, that means for the first 2 years he cannot have any culling or any death loss, or that number changes, that number will go down, or 60 cows or whatever the starting number is, or more revenue is pulled out of this equation for replacements to keep that number stable. And that 2 years means that is actually pretty much the bottom, because calving heifers in at 24 months is typically the goal. It can be done, but that's assuming that within the first 2 months of milking these cows, that you're going to have heifer calves that are born, and they're going to all live, and they're going to all be bred at 15 months, and all going to be pregnant, and they're all going to calve in and start milking again at 24 months. We don't leave any room for error, and that's where, when I look at this, at this kind of return, I do have questions, and Mr. Winan, certainly don't take this the wrong way from me, because you have done what you were instructed to do, and we see the results of what comes out there. But as I look at this, and I'll continue to look at this closer, there are other issues that I would want to make sure we bring forward. The last thing that I will do or would ever want to do is move forward with a program that is not transparent enough for a beginning producer, that does not give them realistic opportunities out there. I think we do have other programs, as you have mentioned in a couple of your other scenarios, and we have tremendous amount of fund availability through Rural Finance Authority. and our beginning farmer program there too that that we should also take a look at too. Representative Otremba.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that one of the columns that I take the most issue with is family living, $30,000. I make $30,000 right now. And it does. There's no way on the farm did we work with $30,000 for family living. And we grew our own food. We made our own clothes. We fixed everything ourselves. There's no way we spent $30,000. If I would have gotten $30,000 for my household, that would have been crazy. I don't know anybody here that spends $30,000 as a dairy farmer for living. Expensive.
But
I mean, seriously.
But you made a good point that I want to make sure that,
you know what,
we understand. But Representative Tremba, please continue.
I think that's an exaggeration. I do not know very many dairy farmers that spend $30,000 on family living in a year. And if somebody around the table here has spent $30,000 a year when they're starting out as a farming, I'd like to know about it, because it just doesn't happen. All the money goes back into the farm, and you basically, you do. You have your own garden, and you do all your own clothes. You do all that stuff. And in most cases, I think the percentage right now of somebody working off-farm,
well,
that is farming, is really high, 80-90%, which probably should be put into this formula somehow too, because that's the reality of farming right now. But I would really take issue with $30,000 as our budget as a household when we're farming.
Representative Conan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In my other life as a part-time milk truck driver, I get on between 25 and 30 different dairy farms, and especially for the younger farmers, I have to agree with Representative Otremba that $30,000 is a pretty generous number. They would love to have that kind of income. On top of that, most of those farms have off-farm income. It's a reality of dairy farming, or farming as a whole, really. And then a question for Mr. Winan. 140 acres, that means they're raising a lot of their own feed. Does this include any of federal farm program payments?
Mr. Chair, Representative Conan. It does not. I did not include that as a part of the equation. In the simplest sense, just to try and keep it as transparent as absolutely possible. So that was not included as part of the equation. And I did not include off-farm income, just from the standpoint of what number do I use? Do I use someone who's flipping burgers or doing some janitorial work in the late evenings? What dollar figure for hourly wage do I use in relation to that? In order to be fair and accurate, the difference would have to be made up by that off-farm income. Someone can easily milk 20, 30 cows and have a family living and make a family living on the farm, but to milk 20, 30 cows and expect that to be your sole source, I think is looking through rose-colored glasses.
Representative Pennis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have to agree. I mean, they're probably living on less than $30,000, but if they, or they're working off the farm, and a lot of them are working off the farm for no other reason to get some health insurance benefits, because I have farmers in my district that are paying between $800 to $1,400 a month for health insurance. And so I always ask them, when does a foreclosure sign go up on your door? You know, it's just not possible. But I see you say in here that if you are planning to have less than 65 cows, that you're going to have off the farm income to help defray that. Anyway, just a comment.
Thank you, Representative Pennis. Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question is for Mr. Winan. You know, one test that I would use if I was looking at this is this something that I would take to the bank? Would I be comfortable taking these scenarios to the bank with a farm business manager, sitting down in front of the loan officer and asking them for a loan? You know, when I look at 20 cows and we're using 140 acres, then we're going up to 60 cows or even 80 cows if we're still at 140 acres, we could run a number of different scenarios, granted, and this could keep you very busy and you could come back to us with probably many more spreadsheets. But I don't know if we did this study justice by using the simple diagram that we have in front of us. And I think that Representative Blaine, or Chairman Blaine, and others around the table have really made some good points. Now, I know of a farm business manager down in southeast Minnesota who does a very good job, who works with many farmers. And I'm assuming that Jim Kelm also does a very good job. I know the farm business management program is very successful and has helped a number of farmers improve their bottom line. Would it be possible that we bring Jim Kelm or another farm business manager here, follow up with some other scenarios that are more realistic that we could take, that we could honestly take to the bank, and we'd honestly sit down with a loan officer and we'd be comfortable presenting those numbers and then take a look at Mary, Representative Otremba's scenario with adding in the $10,000 or the dollar per hundred weight program. So my question is, you know, can we look at these numbers again? Can we bring back a farm business manager and really study the program?
Mr. Chair, Representative Welty, yes, that is very possible. The farm business management instructors are just finishing up working with producers right now, finishing up their taxes, and Jim Kelm is very available and willing to come forward and answer questions as it relates to this. Absolutely.
Mr. Winan, you said that you thought there would be about 60 possible or there's about 60 potential individuals who would be looking to start dairying this coming year. Is that a number that has been about the average of what's entered the industry, let's say, over the past 5 years?
Mr. Chair, yes. It fluctuates anywhere from 60 to 70 new farms come online each and every year. Now, some of that is transfer from one generation to the next. Some of that is new development, brand new, opening up a greenfield development, and some of those are operations that are repopulating barns that have been set empty for a while.
Would it be possible to get a breakdown, a breakdown of let's say, these beginning farmers, the true beginning farmers? I'm not talking about ones that have begun on a multi-generation where the farm has been passed down, but new farmers entering the industry out there, the dairy industry, and be able to look at some of these same inputs that we looked at in this scenario. You know, how much land, how many cows are they milking, what kind of production numbers are they attaining in those first 5 years? Is it possible to access that information and still be able to provide anonymity to the producer?
Mr. Chair, that information isn't readily acceptable or accessible. Thank you. But could be obtained through channels.
Okay. That's a good question, yes. Mr. Winan, can you refresh my memory how much money was appropriated by the legislature to do this study?
Mr. Chair, $0.
Okay, yeah, that's a good point. And maybe, members, maybe that's why this probably wasn't as in-depth as we may like to see. My good friend, Representative Heidgerken,
Thank you, got a question for us. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Page 4 there, we were going over the numbers, assumptions are based on the beginning producer. Renting a barn, 140 acres of 16.5, et cetera, et cetera. There's discrepancies in there in regards to farm programs, what's available there, and plus that there is no way 16.5, you're going to rent machinery and everything else, it's not in reality. But yet at the same time, Representative Trimble, I like the idea of beginning farm. I have quite a few in my district now that are 30, 35 co-operators that have just started up, and any help would be immensely appreciated. But I think we've got some ideas here, and I think that's something we need to pursue. And we need to start someplace. This is a starting point. So with that in mind, I just want to comment on that. So I know of a couple, and some of them said that there's no way you can make a living on. I know of a couple good buddies of mine that's all in milk at 25 cows, and they make a living. So that scenario, can you make a living? Yes. They make a living, but they have their farms paid for.
Thank you for your comments, Representative Heidgerken. Other questions or comments?
The comment, Mr. Chair, it did pass out of the Senate A Committee with only one dissension.
Okay. That shows the soul's question. No. Any other questions or comments, members? Mr. Winand, I thank you for presenting this to us today, and I'm sure we will continue to have discussions on this program, but certainly appreciate your work in preparing this for us today. If there is nothing else, members, at this time I will say that this meeting is adjourned.